I know what some of you are thinking. You're thinking that we're here to honor Ed Meese today. So why are we making him sing for his supper or his lunch, as it were? And I think the answer to that question is this is the Federalist Society. We're a group that's interested in ideas. Other Californians may be at the beach today or maybe the mall or something. But we wouldn't miss this opportunity for the world. And so, Mr. Meese, you can know that if James Madison himself were to come back from the dead, we'd make him sing for his supper, too.
Well, you know, I can't help but say that as I was listening to these very kind words this morning, the analogy to a eulogy did kind of creep into my thinking. And then when somebody talked about a wake, I knew, well, at least some had in mind. But I just want to thank the Federalist Society for letting the corpse have a rebuttal.
You know, obviously Mr. Meese has one heck of a resume. You already have learned quite a bit about him if you didn't know it already. But rather than go through that resume, I know what you want to do. You want to hear from Mr. Meese. So why don't we just launch right into to the interview. And let me start with the most basic of questions here. And that is, how did you connect up with Ronald Reagan? How did you meet him? How did you wind up working for him?
Well, it was kind of I like to think of it as sort of a historical accident. Ronald Reagan was elected in 1966. And in December of that year, I was practicing law in Oakland, California. I was a deputy district attorney there. And one day, I remember it well, it was a Friday. And on Friday, we had a habit, as Lois will remember, that when somebody had won a big case, if that had happened that week, we'd kind of have a party at 5 o'clock in the law library. And on this particular occasion, somebody called me and said, there's somebody from Sacramento wants to talk to you on the phone. And so out of the blue, this call had come in, and they said, we're setting up Ronald Reagan's staff. Would you come up to Sacramento on Monday? So I drove up there, and I didn't realize how they had gotten my name until 8 years later, when I found out that someone, I had done some legislative work back in the early 1960s representing the district attorneys and peace officers associations of California. Somebody recommended, remembered me from that and recommended me to Ronald Reagan. So I drove up and met the transition team, and they talked to me a while, and then they asked me to come up again, and they talked to me some more, and finally, they said, have you talked to your boss about leaving? And I said, no, you don't talk to Frank Coakley about leaving unless you're going to leave. and I said, besides, you haven't offered me a job yet. And I was really enjoyed what I was doing, and I had no real desire to leave. So then they said, well, come back next Monday and talk to Ronald Reagan. And so I came in. I'd never met him before. He walked in. I was tremendously impressed with his cheerfulness, just greeting the staff as he walked into the headquarters there. And we talked for a half hour, and I was really impressed by how much he knew about criminal law, for example, and law enforcement, things I knew a lot about because I'd worked in that field for 8 years. So at the end of the interview, half hour, he offered me the job. I accepted on the spot and then drove home figuring out how I was going to tell my wife we were moving to Sacramento.
Now, was the Ronald Reagan that you met on that occasion, was he the Ronald Reagan that history knows, or was he a work in progress?
I think the answer is both. He already had a lot of ideas. He knew where he wanted to go as governor of California. He had a very firm philosophical foundation. But obviously, as he went through the 8 years as governor, he obviously learned and was able to utilize what he had learned and work it right into the way in which he acted. There was nothing fundamentally different from Ronald Reagan at the end of 8 years or at the end of the presidency in terms of personality, commitment, and all that sort of thing. But obviously, he had acquired a great deal of experience during those years, which he put to good use.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a somewhat harder question because your temptation is going to be modest, and I want you to resist that temptation. And that is, what did he see in you? What skills did you have that you think were particularly valuable to him? How did your skills and talents complement his?
Well, I don't know what he saw me originally. I think he kind of took me on faith because we didn't know each other. But I would say this, and I would say that probably it would have been true of any lawyer who served in the capacity I was as legal affairs secretary, and that was to kind of be a sounding board for him on matters related to law. My responsibilities were to deal with the legal community, the judicial community, the law enforcement community, as well as local government and community relations. And so it was to kind of handle those aspects, which I fortunately had had time in the district attorney's office, both as a trial lawyer, but also in administrative work, organizing public agency coordinating committees, working with the police, involved in police training, a lot of things like that that I was assigned to. And so I tried to bring those skills into the governor's office, but also to be kind of a sounding board on a lot of ideas. And it wasn't just me. Others, likewise, he did that with. And as a matter of fact, those who know him well know that a lot of times when he's talking with you, he's trying out jokes. Ted Olson will know this. He'll try out a joke, and if it goes with you, well, then he'll use it in the speech 24 hours later. So being a sounding board, and also I think one thing, and that was to provide him with accurate legal advice. His personal lawyer was William French Smith, who's been referred to today. And I must say that it was a great honor to follow Bill Smith in the Attorney General's office, but also to follow a path that he had started in the federal government. And so he had, Bill, and along with Ted and Ken Starr, handled that in terms of his legal and financial matters. I tried to do the same thing in terms of the policy matters and the way in which the governor's office ran.
How would you describe him as a boss? And I mean, not just the good qualities. So far, you said only positive things.
Well,
what was his least endearing quality as a boss? And you know, you can tell us. We won't tell anyone.
yeah, that's like saying this is off the record, right? Well, I would say not the least endearing, because I don't know of any unendearing qualities that he had. He was by far the best boss I've ever had. The most generous, the most friendly person. But I would say that if he had a weakness, it was to trust people more than sometimes they deserved. And he just hated to fire anybody. I mean, that was like, that was not even like pulling teeth. That was root canal work for him.
Did you ever have to do it for him?
Well, I must say on occasion I did. when I was in the governor's office, we kind of worked it out between us so that he was a little more comfortable, and that is, we had worked out in advance that so-and-so unfortunately had to go. And it didn't happen many times. I can think of only two or three instances in 8 years. But we worked it out that I would bring the bad news to the individual and then say, but you might want to talk to the governor about it if you're not satisfied with what I've had to say. And we go into the governor's office, and then he would say, what Ed told you is correct.
Now, your first job with President Reagan was as counselor to the president.
Right.
And then later, of course, attorney general. But in that first term, could you see any real differences between the culture, the political culture of Sacramento and the political culture of Washington?
Yes, there were real differences, and they really fell into, I think, two categories, maybe three. One thing, of course, was the scope of the job was so much greater. You had foreign affairs, and we didn't have a separate foreign policy in California, despite what a lot of people thought. And as a matter of fact, for those old-timers here, it was only Sam Yorty, the mayor of Los Angeles, who had a separate foreign policy. So that was obviously one thing. A second thing was the ubiquitousness of the news media. In Sacramento, you had a press conference once a week. But other than that, they didn't really bother you much unless something big was going on. But even then, they weren't always hounding. And by and large, they did something unusual for the news media. They reported the news. There was much less interest in who was stabbing who in the back or who was up, who was down, the kinds of things that seemed to be the major fodder for the Washington, D.C. News Corps, which has little to do with what's happening, but more with who's happening and who's doing what to whom. And that leads me to the third thing, and that was the knives are a lot sharper in Washington, D.C., and they're more likely to wind up in your back than they are is the situation in Sacramento, which is pretty straightforward, even among opposite members, people on the other side opposing political parties.
Looks like you survived them, though, fortunately.
You got to see the scars.
Now, I remember where I was on March 30th, 1981. I was a law student. I'd been up in the stacks in the library. And when I came down to the reading room. There was no one there. The librarians had disappeared. It was no one was there. And I was confused for a second. I looked up on the balcony, and my best friend was motioning, quick, come here, something awful's happened. Where were you?
I was sitting in my office, and the president had gone out to give a speech, I believe, to a labor union that day at the Washington Hilton. And it was not the kind of speech where, it was a regular speech. One of our guys, Mike Deaver, went with him. Usually one of the three of us, Mike Deaver, Jim Baker, and myself, would go to a speech. But this is one that was not particularly interesting or something that directly related to what I was most interested in. So I stayed behind. And I was sitting there, and somebody came running into my office and said, Jim Brady's been shot. And said, there's been a shooting at the Washington Hilton, and Jim Brady's been hit. And so I went over to the Secret Service place there, the little station they have in the White House, and the agent there didn't know much more than that either. So I went over to the residence to see Nancy Reagan, and her Secret Service agent had already told her, and she was in a car on the way to the hospital. And then I got on the phone with Mike Deaver, who was calling in from the hospital, and he said, the president's been hurt. And I said, has the president been shot? And he said, no, he was hurt getting into the car. And then a minute later, he says, uh-oh. And he said, wait a minute. And then he came back a minute later and said, they just found out the president has been shot. And actually, the reason nobody knew that was that when John Hinckley fired with a small caliber soft-nosed weapon, soft-nosed bullet, the bullet traveled along the side of the car and flattened out so that when it entered the president's body, it was like a skill saw. A miniature skill saw about the size of a dime that had come off of its axle. And so later on, the FBI showed me his coat, and it was like a knife wound in the coat because it came in and it came into his side in the same way. And as a result, they couldn't find a wound when the agent put his hands over him to see if there was a bullet wound. And so they just thought when he started coughing up blood that they had somehow punctured a rib when they tossed him into the car to get away. And it wasn't until the surgeons at the emergency room were examining him they realized it was a bullet wound, which had penetrated his body and got him in and nicked a lung. And it was very close to hitting him in the heart.
Well, events like that can slow a person down.
Well,
did it slow down the administration?
You know, it didn't. I got a hold of a car, and Don Regan had come over from the Treasury Department when he heard about it. Don, as Treasury Secretary, Secret Service provide his security. So I said, I want to get a car with a red light and siren to go to the hospital. And Don said, take my car. So I did, and Lynn Nofziger hopped in the back, and I think Jim Baker, and we sped off to the hospital. And when we got there, Lynn Nofziger said, knowing Jim Brady had been shot, he said, I'll take over the press, because there was this huge mass of news people waiting there. And I went inside, and Jim was with me, and Mike Deaver joined us, and we happened to be there just as he was being rolled from the emergency room to the operating room. And he looks up, and here he is, you know, in dire straits. He looks up, and he sees the three of us, and he says, who's minding the store? And as you know, he made a lot of other jokes in the course of the afternoon. Unbelievable. But what I don't think anything did slow down, to be quite honest. What happened was I got on the phone to Bill Smith to find out if there was anything that he had gotten from the FBI, and also to make sure that to talk with him about putting the FBI on special alert, because we didn't know whether this was part of some larger conspiracy or what it was. And called Cap Weinberger at the Pentagon, and he had moved the defense readiness condition up one notch for the same reason, until we made sure this was all. That there was nothing more to this. And then we kind of held the fort down there in the hospital while he was being operated on. And then by that time, the vice president was on his way back. He had been in Houston, I believe, or somewhere in Texas, and was on his way back. And so when he was about ready to land, I said I would go and meet the vice president and brief him, and that we would then all meet back in the White House. In the meantime, Dick Allen, who was the National Security Assistant, had gotten the rest of the cabinet. We'd been on the phone together. He got the cabinet together in the Situation Room so that if we needed to invoke the 25th Amendment, which provides that a majority of the cabinet can declare the president incapacitated, which would then transfer power to the vice president legally. I went to meet the vice president, and this is another mark of George H.W. Bush. He was a man who always was deferential to the president, and some people said he was landing at Andrews Air Force Base, that he ought to take the helicopter and land on the White House lawn so he could get right to the meeting with the cabinet. And he said no, he didn't want to look like he was jumping the gun and usurping the place of the president. So he landed at his home, the Admiral's House up in the Naval Observatory. I met him there and then briefed him on the way down. And from that point on, things just moved right along. He took the chairmanship of the cabinet there, convened the cabinet, made sure we knew as much. By that time, we had a much better fix that this was an individual incident with John Hinckley. But things continued. The next morning, we had a cabinet meeting over which he presided. A couple of us went to the hospital to see the president. And the big question that had come up the night before is, will he sign the milk bill? Apparently, the Congress that day just finally enacted some bill having to do with the dairy industry, and they were pounding on our legislative liaison people to get the bill signed. So the next morning at 9 o'clock, in somewhat shaky handwriting, Ronald Reagan signed the milk bill. So I think that's a pretty good indication that things were back to normal, relatively speaking.
I'm glad the milk bill got signed. But if that didn't slow down the Reagan administration, what sort of headwinds do you think really were there? What kinds of things? Every administration since George Washington's has had, you know, all sorts of things, the media, political infighting, Congress. What was the biggest problem?
Well, if you look at it over a period of the 8 years, I think the first term, I think particularly as somebody pointed out, I think Ted pointed out and perhaps others, was there were people in the administration who didn't believe in Ronald Reagan. They were more or less loyal to him, but they didn't really believe and be totally committed to his philosophy and his plans, particularly in the first year in the area of tax rate reduction. Ronald Reagan had thought about this a long time, and so when he came in, he had his four-point program for economic revival. A lot of people don't remember, but that was we were in very tough shape in 1980 when he was elected. We had interest rates at 21.5%. We had inflation at 12.5%. Unemployment ultimately rose to 10%. I mean, things that people would think was were impossible today. And he knew from his own study, his own working on this, he talked with a lot of people about economic matters. And so he had his four-point program of tax rate reductions, regulatory reform, slowing the growth of federal spending, and stable monetary policies. And he was convinced that was going to work, as ultimately it did. But there were people who saw and felt that the tax rate reduction would lead to great deficits. So you had people like David Stockman, director of OMB, who got cold feet around September, October. The other thing he wanted to do, of course, was rebuild our military strength, which had deteriorated massively during the latter part of the 1970s, so that we would be once again a reliable ally to our friends and a credible deterrent to our enemies. And so as a result, he was building up the military. And so Stockman had two ideas. One was to increase taxes, and secondly, to slow the budgetary support for the military, both of which directly in conflict with what Ronald Reagan wanted to do. So I would say that, you know, when Stockman leaked this information about trickle-down economics and all that to a guy, Grider, who was writing for some more or less liberal news magazine and things like that, those were the tough things. The other things that were, there were people in the White House and elsewhere who felt that leaking to the press in a way that would help them advance or perhaps be detrimental to those that they viewed as their opponents within the administration was somehow going to help the administration. And, of course, all it did was those were the leaking and catering to the negative aspects of the press, which was a good portion of the press. Those are the kind of things that I think probably were the toughest things to deal with within the White House. Not to say, of course, the political opposition. You had Tip O'Neill, who was a very powerful, probably one of the most powerful speakers of the House that we've had in the 20th century. And Tip had certain things. He disagreed with almost everything Ronald Reagan was doing economically. And he also just absolutely hated the idea of us supporting the freedom fighters in Nicaragua. He had a relative, I think a sister or somebody, who was in some religious order that was sympathetic to the communists in Nicaragua. And as a result, he fought us on every turn on supporting the freedom fighters there. So, obviously, overcoming the political opposition. Then, of course, you had also a lot of people who thought that cutting taxes was somehow un-American, because that meant the federal government couldn't put out as much money and spend as much money as they otherwise would. And so we had to overcome those kinds of things. I would say, you know, you mentioned about the wounding of the president, the attempted assassination. Did that slow anything down? If you have to look at it, I think, in the perspective of history, despite the dangers that were inherent there, the fact that that incident happened may have helped him a great deal. Because the way he reacted, his grace under fire, his way of responding, and the way he recovered and resumed his duties very quickly and with a great deal of grace, I think all of that kind of reassured the country that this was a great leader and helped actually to get both the economic and the defense buildup measures through the Congress.
Now, how did you come to switch jobs from counselor to the president to attorney general?
Bill Smith decided to go back to law practice. I had done a lot of things in the White House having to do with justice because of my background. And so the president talked with me about this. And then I said that if that's what he wanted, I would be happy to do that. And so as a result, he nominated me for attorney general in 1984.
And how did you like the job? How did they compare between your first job as counselor to the president and attorney general?
I liked them both, obviously. They're both great jobs, in case anybody's interested in applying. but I think the order in which those jobs occurred was absolutely the right order. Because in the White House, I was able to see the whole scope of the federal government and to know how the White House worked, which is extremely valuable when I became attorney general. If I had to say which one I like better, it's close. But I think I like being attorney general better because I like the opportunity to lead a large and very effective organization. That was a tremendous opportunity. We had at that time 72,000 employees, and we had a large budget, at least by standards in those days. The department's a lot larger. Well, it's about the same now because they lost some things to Homeland Security. But it was a great group of people. The agencies that are in the Department of Justice are some of the best in the federal government. Ken and Ted and others that are here remember having the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Marshal Service, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, groups such as that, the Bureau of Prisons, the Office of Justice Programs that Lois headed so ably with all kinds of research arms there, juvenile justice and the like, and then to have the largest law office in the world. At that time, I think something in the neighborhood of 5,000 to 6,000 lawyers. Was a great opportunity to really have something that was enjoyable to lead. And the quality of the people was just outstanding. One of the things that I felt at all levels in the department was you had, there's some exceptions, but like any organization, you have a very small group that are probably opposing you. You have what we hope is a larger group that are your total supporters. But in the government, there's a big middle group. And they are, particularly in the Department of Justice, they are professionals that will go in the way that you provide the leadership to go. And that's what I found, and it was just a great experience.
Well, that's an interesting thought, because I tend to think of the civil service and the general federal bureaucracy as leaning left and sort of needing to be pushed back. How did you find it?
Well, it depended on where you were in the department. I would say that in the civil rights division, and I see Brad Reynolds over here, they say leaning left. Was probably an understatement. I would say pushing left was
falling right over.
Was probably more accurate there. Whereas in the FBI and other places, you probably had people that were more conservative by nature. But overall, I would say most of the lawyers in the Department of Justice were professional lawyers. And as I say, they would follow what the law is. As Doug Kamik was talking about this morning so ably, the Office of Legal Counsel, their job was, no matter who the Attorney General was, to tell them accurately what the law was and to give them both sides of an issue, but at the same time to tell them what they thought the law was. And So I think the professionalism of the lawyers and the other people, the law enforcement people and others in the Department of Justice, was probably exceptional, perhaps more so than many other departments in the government, largely because they were lawyers and had a commitment to the law as well as to the department and their job. So there was very little politics or political pressure, except, as I say, in a few places. And I must give Brad tremendous credit for what he did there. He took a group of people. I would say probably when he went in, 90% were of a different opinion on how civil rights should be enforced. And he provided the leadership. He and Chuck Cooper and the other people that he had working for him provided the leadership and also the legal rationale for what they were doing, so that these people had to return to their roots as lawyers rather than as advocates for a particular point of view. And as a result, we had, I think, a very effective shift in bringing civil rights enforcement back to, as some have mentioned this morning, back to the whole principle of equality under the law, which hadn't always been the case up to that time.
Well, tell me this. When you started as Attorney General, did you and the President have a list of things that you wanted to accomplish in particular, either on paper or in your head, or was it more by ear?
Well, I think we developed a list, and I think the President in the first term, through his speeches, through his cabinet meetings, other things, had indicated directions in which he wanted to go. For example, that judges was a very important aspect of the appointment of constitutionally faithful judges. Talking about equality under the law, getting away from quotas and preferences and racial discrimination disguised as other things. He had talked about strong law enforcement. He had talked particularly about dealing with the problem of drugs. And so there were a lot of things that were pretty much had in mind. As Ken mentioned this morning, a team during the transition had come together and gave me ideas of what they thought ought to be involved. And then in the course of the first year, we had a planning conference. We had it down at the FBI Academy, if I remember, the first one. We had them every year. But we had it, and we made up, and that was attended by about 15 or 20 of the top component heads, the assistant attorneys general, and people who are heads of our largest components, the FBI and drug enforcement and others. And we spent 2 days down there, and we developed two lists. One was a list of policy issues that we would deal with, and the second was a list of management objectives that we've had for where the department ought to be going. So we had both an informal idea coming in, but then we formalized that in terms of specific goals and objectives.
So what about with judicial nominations? How did that work? How did you institutionalize that?
Well, that was one of the things where a lot of the people who had been working on that had left the department at the end of the first term. And so it was a matter of reviving kind of and developing a system. And so we found a fellow, I think Ken or Brad or somebody, found a fellow by the name of Rocky Reese. Rocky Reese was a member of the Federalist Society, as Ken reminds me, and we called Rocky. We brought Rocky in and gave him an offer he couldn't refuse, and he became our chief of our judicial selection branch. Steve Markman hadn't arrived by that time, but Rocky set up the system and started the process going. And the system involved a number of things, and that was getting virtually everybody in the department involved. We got all the assistant attorneys general were brought in, and they were part of the interviews that a potential candidate for judge would go through, talking with anywhere from 4 to 6, sometimes more of them, so that you had a broad frame of reference in terms of questioning the potential candidates. And then obviously we had a team that was developed to read all of their opinions if they were judges, read all their law review articles if they were law professors, look back at their cases and what their professional reputation was, and then add that to what the ABA was doing, what the FBI was doing, and pull that all together into then a winnowing process before we brought the recommendations over to the President. So it was a real system. Then when Steve Markman came in, this was further refined under his leadership and worked out to be a very effective process, extremely detailed, with a number of people, so that we could, in fact, make sure that the people that we ultimately recommended to the President would fit his view of constitutionally faithful judges. And Steve did a tremendous job on that. And if I could add one other thing, thinking of Steve, one of the things about our Justice Department was we had some really top lawyers. It was one of the greatest teams I've ever worked with. And whatever I might have been said to have accomplished in the kind words today, I can tell you that is not my doing. That really was the team that was there, many of them who are here today. It was a great team operation. And because they were such really great legal intellects, Steve initiated a series along with the help of others. Ken was particularly helpful on this. Mike Uhlman was involved in this, as I remember. And it was bringing in legal scholars, people like Lino Graglia and other people like that from around the country, so that we would have kind of academic sessions, lunches, for all of our assistant attorneys general and some of the other key people in the department on a regular basis, two or three times a quarter usually. And we would deal with major legal problems, not just in the Department of Justice, but in the profession generally, as they related in the long-term view to the legal profession and thus to the department in that sense. And as a result, then, we got into detailed legal research on some of these things, issues like the exclusionary rule, issues like some of the civil law concepts, a number of constitutional issues. And Steve and his OLP, Office of Legal Policy, then developed what were known as the Blue Books. And it was a series of blue monographs, if you will, usually around 30 to 50 pages, in which they provided the intellectual background, the legal scholarly background for a lot of the issues we were facing, so that at no time were we just handling cases on a day-to-day basis, but we were looking at the state of the law, particularly as it related to the department and to the administration, from a more academic viewpoint to match with the day-to-day practice that we were all involved in.
Can I get you to comment on the Bork nomination in particular?
Yeah, one of the great tragedies in legal jurisprudence, in my mind. Bob Bork was probably certainly one of the most qualified persons ever nominated to the Supreme Court. And he had been a contender earlier when the president had other nominations, and when this nomination came through, Lewis Powell was the one who had retired, and we took up some more names to talk to the president about, but we didn't need to because the one name he had in mind was Robert Bork. And what had happened was, we're now talking about 1987, the summer of 1987, and in the 86 elections, the leadership of the Senate had gone from Republican to Democrat. What had happened there was that Ronald Reagan won so overwhelmingly in 1980 that he carried with him about seven Republicans in Senate seats around the country they had never hoped to win. But he was so popular that he carried these people in. Well, 6 years later, they were on their own, and not all of them survived. And so as a result, I think we were down to about somewhere in the neighborhood of 48-52, something like that. So the Democrats now had regained leadership in the Senate. Secondly, you had a lot of left-wing groups that had been just outraged by the fact that the president had appointed, on our recommendation, a lot of constitutionally faithful lawyers. Because, you know, the left knows they can't win anything in elections. They can't win anything through the normal legislative process, either through Congress or state legislatures. So they try to go around the people's representatives and get things by finding susceptible judges. And that's why they wanted to try to stop the continued appointment of constitutionally faithful judges. So they were just hammering all over these Democrats to resist constitutionally faithful judges. And the third thing was these outside groups had raised a lot of money, unbeknownst to us. And what they did was they turned we knew it would be a tough confirmation process, but we thought it would be a legitimate one, similar to confirmations in the past. And what they did, they turned it into a political contest. They had television ads in the home states of senators that were key. They had this tremendous character assassination campaign in the news media against Bob Bork, and so on. And so as a result of all of that, that was how they were able to persuade virtually all the Democrats, and even, I believe, one or two Republicans. And as a result, Bob was denied that nomination. And as I say, it was a tremendous disappointment to us, but more than that, it was a great injury, I think, to constitutional jurisprudence.
So do you think you might have been able to turn it around had you known how it was going to be politicized in the way that it was?
I think so, because we've seen that happening in the Roberts and Alito cases, and the conservative supporters of President Bush were ready. They raised money to counter with television ads. They had grassroots groups to match the grassroots groups of the left, and as a result, that was how they were able to turn the tide in the case of both Roberts and Alito. They didn't have nearly as much money as the left has. But with a very small amount of money comparatively, they were able nevertheless to use skill and a good deal of strategy and galvanizing grassroots to be successful in these two nominations.
Which means there was a silver lining to the Bork nomination.
Well, there was, but at a great price to the people of the country.
You know, there are only 9 justices on the Supreme Court, and obviously no one president gets to appoint them all except George Washington. Who would have been on your list that didn't quite make it, that you would have liked to have seen on the Supreme Court?
Well, Bob Bork, obviously. There were others. I've always refrained from really commenting on people who didn't get a job. It's dangerous. For one thing, you might leave somebody off the list who just by lack of memory. But there were a number of good prospects. I mean, you can look at the people that Ronald Reagan appointed to the courts of appeal around the country, and there were a lot of excellent ones, many of whom are now rising to positions of chief justice or chief judge because of their longevity and so on. So there were an awful lot of them, so I wouldn't want to pick out one from about 10 I could probably, with a little thought, think of.
Okay. Then the 1970s were a time of, you know, the end of the Vietnam War, Watergate, Jimmy Carter's malaise of the American people. It was a time of expansion of power of Congress. And one of the hallmarks, of course, of the Reagan administration was the reassertion of executive authority. How did you do that?
Well, it was interesting because Jimmy Carter had managed to downgrade the presidency, I guess is the most charitable way of phrasing it, so that people at that time, as you point out, people were saying that the presidency was too big for one person. They were even talking about a three-person presidency where the powers of the executive would be divided among more than one person, and so on. And I think that it had gotten so bad, and we had such economic problems in the country, energy problems, obviously things were going poorly with our leadership in the world. We were literally, I won't say losing the Cold War, but certainly in danger of losing the Cold War, and that was pretty well recognized. So really, sometimes things, the old saying is things have to get worse before they get better. Well, they did. And so I think it was the fact that the country was ready for someone like Ronald Reagan. Now, initially, people think today it was a cakewalk. It wasn't. There was by no means ordained that he would be the Republican candidate, let alone be elected president. And the Republican establishment nationally was against him. They wanted someone like George H.W. Bush or Howard Baker or one of the known political figures in Washington. The news media was belittling him pretty much. He surprised everybody, first of all, by getting the nomination or by getting the votes in order to get the nomination, which he got pretty handily. And that was because of his tremendous appeal to the people of the country in the primaries as he went around the country. But once that having happened, Carter was just overjoyed because he figured Ronald Reagan, of all these candidates, had all these big names in Washington. Here was this cowboy from the West that he would be the easiest one to beat. And, of course, what Ronald Reagan did was substantially beat Carter in the campaign. And then, as soon as he got into office, he didn't waste a minute, literally. He had these plans of what he wanted to do and presented it to the people. So he had both a vision of where he wanted the country to go and then the ability to communicate that vision to the American people. And I think that's really what happened. By the time the 8 years was over, nobody was saying that the presidency was too big for one person. And he really turned it around himself by the force of his leadership as well as by the good ideas that he had.
Well, one of the things that interests me in terms of reassertion of executive authority are things like the Independent Counsel Act.
Mm-hmm.
During the 1980s, people were thinking that you know, this is something that conservatives are interested in. And then during the Clinton administration, lo and behold, suddenly other people were looking at the Independent Counsel Act and thinking, well, maybe this isn't such a great idea. What do you think about that?
Well, I think right from the start, even before Ronald Reagan took office, just as people outside of government, many of us thought that the Independent Counsel Act was a terrible act when it was originally passed by Congress, as Congress's revenge basically against the Nixon administration. That was really the origins of that particular act, and thought it was very clearly a violation of separation of powers and a violation of the Constitution. And quite frankly, in 1987, when this case came before the Supreme Court, it's one of the two times in the president's 8 years of office that I think the Supreme Court blinked, largely because of, in both cases, largely because they thought that public opinion was on the other side. It's a kind of a terrible indictment of the Supreme Court, but it's the only way I can explain what they did. One was in 1982, which Ted will remember, where the Department of Justice and Department of Treasury both held and believed that the IRS, Internal Revenue Service, could not on their own, without some statute or statutory authority, take away the tax exemption of an educational institution simply because that institution had some strange ideas about mixing the races. And there the Supreme Court, on a very convoluted opinion, held against the position of the government. In 87, it was even worse. And in the most convoluted opinion that I have ever read, the court found that the independent counsel was constitutional, even to the point of saying in the opinion that the independent counsel, who had all the powers of the attorney general under the independent counsel statute, was an inferior officer and not a major officer of the government. And so I think, so we thought that that was just absolutely wrong. Ultimately, the Congress realized that the independent counsel was not a good idea. And really, our feeling was not confined to who it was used against, but there were two principles that it violated. One was that every federal officer ought to be responsible to someone, ultimately, who was elected by the people. And that's why everybody in the executive branch, under normal circumstances, are responsible through the cabinet secretaries to the president, who ultimately is held responsible for the executive branch. The other thing was that the independent counsel system turned criminal law jurisprudence on its head. In the criminal law situation, in the normal criminal law prosecution or investigation, first of all, you have to have a crime. And then you try to find out who did it and prosecute that person. In the independent counsel statute, literally, in most cases, it turned out first you pick a victim or a target, and then you try to find a crime to match the person. And so the independent counsel statute was a bad idea from the start. And as a matter of fact, if I can digress just a moment, we have an example of that going on at the present time with Scooter Libby, which I want to use this opportunity to ride one of my pet hobby horses. But I think this is one of the most appalling prosecutions that I have seen in now almost 50 years of law practice. Any prosecutor with half a brain who looked into that case would have found within the first 48 hours that no crime had been committed. And therefore, it would have been unnecessary to go beyond that to interrogate anybody, Scooter Libby, Karl Rove, or anybody else. But instead, there's a syndrome that builds up with a special prosecutor that they've got to somehow justify their existence and carry everything beyond what any responsible professional prosecutor would do. And that's why there's so much opportunity for injustice in this particular law. And that's why I'm happy to say it fell of its own weight. And I think one of our jobs as lawyers is to keep reminding any future Congress that you can't cut corners with the Constitution without very dire results for the people, and particularly for the protection of innocent people.
I'm curious, you were saying that the Supreme Court may have acted the way it did here because it thought that the American people would have objected to a decision the other way. And it's probably, at least, you know, and to my mind, somewhat true that the American people don't really think of the status of the executive the way people who've worked for the Department of Justice or worked for the president do. And I remember when I was in high school during the Watergate hearings, that I first read in the paper that President Nixon was invoking executive privilege. I'd never heard of executive privilege. I was like a 10th grader. But nobody I knew had ever heard of executive privilege, and I would read in the newspapers, and from what it sounded in the newspapers, Nixon had made it up, which, of course, was not at all true. And it wasn't until I got to law school that I learned that that was not at all true, and there was a long tradition behind executive privilege. Is this a tough sell on the American people inherently, or is it because no one's willing to talk about it?
Well, I think that in retrospect, Richard Nixon gave executive privilege a bad name. And that is, when you use executive privilege to try to cover up misdeeds within an administration, even though it might be technically applicable, it makes it very tough to sell to the American people, as you suggest. And most real invocation of executive privilege is done by a president, as was done by Ronald Reagan during both the first and the second terms, to deny Congress certain information which the Constitution puts within the province of the executive. The whole idea of the unitary executive that was talked about before, the whole idea of everybody being responsible to the president having power to get information from those who advise him and who assist him, the ability of the executive branch to go about their business without having things that ought to remain confidential, whether they're national security matters or matters of important decisions and so on, without having them revealed from the public, is really what the executive privilege is all about. And when it is used for other purposes, or apparently used for other purposes, that makes it tough. But I think one of the things is, it's hard to explain to the American public. To some, it's rather an arcane legal theory or legal concept. And so, and usually it comes to public attention when there is something like the Watergate or something like that. And so that's why it's so difficult. Whereas many times it's used in a much more benign situation, simply because of a battle between the executive branch and Congress over some particular piece of information. But it's absolutely critical that a president, in order to get candid advice from his principal advisors, whether it be on personnel matters, whether it be on matters of policy, whether it be on matters of national defense, that he has the ability to keep that information from becoming public. And from becoming public, that means not letting it go up to Congress, because there's no way in the world, once information goes to Congress, that it's not going to be somehow be kept available to the public through the news media or otherwise.
You know something, General Meese, I have 1,000 questions in my lap here, but the audience is going to kill me if I do not provide at least a little bit of an opportunity to get questions from the audience here. I'm going to reserve one question, and I am going to turn to you. Do you have any questions for General Meese? Professor Lowenstein.
Yes. Gail authorized me to ask this question. And I want to ask you to reflect on two things that were done during Governor Reagan's administration, mm-hmm. and not selected randomly. I think they're different because of the consequences that have been surely mixed up.
Well, the closing of the mental hospitals, actually, at the time, this was billed by leading leaders in the field of mental health, by Congress, or by legislators, state legislators who had looked into this, Frank Latterman being one, chairman of the committee that had this, and a lot of other experts, a lot of doctors and so on, that this was the wave of the future in the treatment of mental illness. And that was to stop warehousing, as they called it, the mentally ill with no real treatment other than kind of keeping them sedated to keep them under control, but rather that the community mental health facilities should be utilized for those people who didn't really need incarceration, and that they would be given medicine because a lot of new drugs had been developed over a period of time, and that they should be treated more as patients than as prisoners, and treated in their local communities. And that was what was behind the Landerman bill in California. Now, what happened as a result of that was a couple things happened. One is, I think that there was in many communities, they did not build or develop the community mental facilities, mental health facilities, that would enable adequate numbers of people to be treated. Secondly, a lot of people, the civil rights laws and other laws against forcible incarceration in community facilities kicked in so that these people could not be picked up unless they were a danger to themselves and or others, and therefore it was very hard to compel these people to get treatment, and it was impossible for the most part to get them to take their medicine on a regular basis. And so those were the major problems. But I think the original purpose of this was a beneficent one, and one that was in keeping with the best of the mental health literature at the time. I think it's still the case today. I think there can be a lot of improvements in that field. We see this particularly with the street people and with the homeless people. But part of it is getting over this hurdle of not being able to pick people up and compel them to have the mental health treatment that many of them need. In terms of, are you talking about the no-fault divorce law? I don't really remember much about that as a matter of fact, so it didn't really become a matter of great moment as far as the governor's signature. I think it was passed, if I recall correctly, and I don't have much of a recollection, so that leads me to believe it wasn't a great matter of controversy at the time, but it was pretty easily passed by the state legislature, and therefore I don't think there was much protest about the governor signing it because of the fact that there hadn't been a lot of controversy in the legislature. I'm sure there were some people, but I don't have much recollection of it, so it wasn't a matter of great moment. I thought you were going to talk about, you're going to ask me about the other thing that was of great moment, and that is the signing of the abortion law. That was one, and this is kind of typical, and the reason I mention it is it illustrates a little bit about Ronald Reagan. He really agonized over this, and he had for over a week, he devoted his time to nothing but talking with doctors, talking with people from a variety of religious backgrounds, talking with marriage experts, a whole lot of people. And he came to the conclusion that the basis for abortion, allowing abortion in California, was based upon the health of the mother. And so he felt that there was it was called the therapeutic abortion law, if I remember correctly. And he felt that because it had a medical reason, and I think he was to a great extent influenced actually by Nancy's father, who was a very famous physician and a very famous medical school professor, that if there were genuine health reasons, it should be permitted. He thought it would be a relatively small number. Later on, years later, toward the end of his governorship, he was really disappointed, as he said, in the medical profession, because it turned out it was very easy to get one psychiatrist to say this would affect the mental health of the mother, to get another psychiatrist to join on, and then to get a third opinion to make it happen, and it turned into abortion almost on request. And he was very disappointed. He felt he'd been betrayed by the medical profession, and if he had had to do over again, he wouldn't have signed such a bill.
Yes.
Excuse me.
The question has to do with international law, and how did the Justice Department view international law? Actually, at the time we were there, some 20 years ago, we didn't have quite as much international law as we have now, which is a good thing. But but we took the position that there was great need to very thoroughly examine any proposal for expanding international law. At that time, I don't think the International Criminal Court was even a concept, or at least wasn't one that was bothering the United States. And we had some severe concerns about the International Court of Justice, which was in existence. We also were very much concerned about international agreements, treaties, conventions, and all that sort of thing, because what had happened was that what used to be the idea of treaties, and that was documents and agreements that related to the relationship between nations, that because of the UN conventions and other kinds of treaties, Law of the Sea Treaty and other things, what they were doing was not just handling the relationship between nations, but we're really talking about domestic policy, and that through these treaties, and therefore circumventing the usual legislative activity through the Congress. And even though the Senate has the ability to ratify, nevertheless, these things were dealing with all kinds of aspects of domestic law. So I think it's, I thought then, and now today, when we have many more attempts to internationalize domestic policy, I think it's a very dangerous thing. And there are a lot of conventions rolling around, and I was very proud that George W. Bush unsigned some of the conventions and some of the treaties that had been signed and submitted to the Senate by Bill Clinton. But it's a very dangerous area to allow the United States to be governed, particularly by people in the diplomatic community who are often kind of an intellectual elite who have their own idea of how the world ought to be run. And it's not the way most people in the United States want, at least our world, to be run here in this country.
Yes.
Okay, in view of what has happened since the amnesty in the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, what advice do we have for George W. Bush? I'm actually on record in an article that I wrote that was published in Human Events a few weeks ago. We learned a lot in 1986. For a while after the amnesty, and at that time there were about 3 million illegal aliens in the United States, we learned a lot. For about 2 years, and the amnesty was only a part of the picture. Increased border control and increased sanctions against employers who illegally employed illegal aliens, all of these were part of the whole mix. The amnesty part worked in terms of the people that were affected. They were the kinds of people that originally thought this would be the way that these people could legitimize their existence here. What didn't happen was a continuing effort at increasing border control and border safety, security, and also the enforcement of the employer sanctions also sort of petered out over a period of time. As a result of this, and that's why today we have some 12 million illegal aliens in the United States, my advice to the president was that amnesty, no matter what you call it, where you allow people to stay in this country who are here illegally, will not work again and should not be a part of the legislation. Rather, I have suggested that we give opportunities for those who legitimately want to legalize their existence, give them opportunities to go back to their country of origin, let them apply and stand in line with the other people that are there, but at the same time simplify the process and make it easier for people who genuinely want to come to this country to do so, particularly as temporary workers. But make sure that we have the safeguards in place, which you can do now with identification, biometric identification, computerized searches, and that sort of thing, to make sure that those who are here temporarily are going to go back. And those who genuinely want to become citizens then join that process. But definitely, if we allow people to stay here, we're only going to make sure there's an incentive then for other people to come in illegally. Obviously, we have to do a better job on border security. But one of the aspects of a sovereign nation is the ability to control population increases through immigration. And we've got to do that, not just for making sure that we have assimilation into our culture, which has to be one part of any immigration policy, but also to protect against those people who are coming in illegally for illegal purposes, including terrorists, including people who are smuggling drugs and those other kinds of things. So a combination of border security, improved border security, improved cracking down on employers, the hiring illegal aliens, a better temporary worker system, providing an opportunity for people to leave and then come back legally. I think all of those things are the only way in which we're going to have an immigration policy and changes in immigration policy. They're going to work in the long term. So what Ronald Reagan, as a humanitarian effort in response to the recommendations of a bipartisan commission back in 86 did, without recognizing at the time, has given us some powerful lessons of how we ought to handle this particular situation 20 years later.
Well, I get the last question here.
All right.
And it's this. I was at Borders Bookstore just last week in the children's department looking for a baby shower present, and I saw a book on the shelf that said Great Lawyers. And I thought, how cute. Here's a little book, you know, to inspire the future lawyers of America. And I opened it up, and they had Robespierre in there. So I bought a different book. I bought a book about a bunny rabbit instead. But at any rate, I thought it's not just the future lawyers of America who need inspiration. It's the present lawyers and law students. And I was wondering, who do you think the two or three greatest lawyers of the 20th century were?
That's an interesting question. we had a lot of great lawyers during that period of time. I know right off who I don't think of in that category. Ramsey Clark comes to mind.
Lawyers or judges?
Lawyers or judges? Well, I think that in terms of great lawyers, I think there's no question in my mind that Bob Bork is as one of the greatest lawyers that we have in the country today. I will spare Ted Olson the embarrassment of naming him, but he certainly would be in the running, as would several of the other people that I see in front of me here. I think Nino Scalia is a great lawyer, and I would also choose Clarence Thomas. And the reason I say this is in terms of these, particularly Clarence Thomas, if you read his opinions, they are probably the best written, clearest opinion of any justice that I've seen in the court in the 20th century. And, of course, he laps over into the 21st now. But he is clear. And the other thing is, there was an article written by Stuart Taylor, who writes a lot for American Lawyer and other magazines, and he says, justices need to remind themselves that one of the aspects of a good judge is humility. And he quoted Richard Posner on some of the problems with some judges who got kind of stuck on themselves and think they have the answer to every problem. Well, Clarence has never suffered from that. And obviously, Nino Scalia with his brilliant mind. I would say these are three of the best lawyers that I know of in the 20th century. And I consider it a privilege that I've had the ability to know them, as most of us have here. We can see them. Now, there may have been some in the early part of the 20th century, but I don't know when in the 20th century there have been any tougher legal issues to deal with. And when you go back in those days and read Supreme Court decisions, most of them would be kind of arcane decisions on the Commerce Clause before it was corrupted. And a few other cases like that. But when you get into the tough issues today of separation of powers and federalism and some of these sorts of things, I think we have some of the toughest, and the international law that was mentioned earlier, I think we have some of the toughest challenges for great lawyers today than we've ever had. But I also think, quite frankly, we have the lawyers today to meet those challenges, and that's why I consider it such a privilege to be part of the Federalist Society, because I think through this organization, we not only have the lawyers today, but we're going to have them in the future.
Well, General Meese, I'm sure that many people in the audience recognize that I saved that question for last because we consider you to be one of our great legal heroes, and we thank you so much for coming out here and allowing us to honor you.
Thank you.